The humble leader is a confident leader, and humbleness is an alpha behavior, because you know you don't need to go brag about what you do, how you do it, or you know your competence. It just is. It's self-evident. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. And we're rolling. This is Dr. William Curtis, and Lieutenant Colonel Chris Story is on the other line. And are you still in Pennsylvania?
I am. You know, I am drinking a beer on a Wednesday, which I normally try not to do, so it must be getting close to the end of tour time. So
I guess so, yeah. Well, welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast, if those of you listening. Today we have, let's call it random show number 98, since we're getting close to the century mark for this podcast. I guess first off, before we get into our sort of randomness that probably is how we started this show, what have you been, you got the big move coming up.
Yeah, it's always bittersweet. I mean, people ask us about it a lot, and I say us because not just me as a service member, but my wife being a military spouse and my kids, you know, being in different grades in school with kids that are traditionally not military background, maybe. So, you know, it is interesting when you get to this point because in a lot of ways, you're ready to move on, but you've made some new friends and, you know, had some highs in the job. And so I think it's always a good time to reflect, you know, and every 2 to 3 years you get to reinvent yourself in a way. So you know, we're kind of in that spot as a family right now.
Right. So ready for the big move. You know, I was just thinking about with like kids and stuff, it must be tough on them moving, you know, military family. But I also think that maybe with whole, you know, like social media and how connected everybody is now, maybe it's not as hard. I'm not sure.
It's definitely easier because you can stay connected in a good way. And I think we've touched on it before about, you know, probably for every you know, drawback, there's a positive of social media if you use it, if you use the power for good, you know, as analogy used in a lot of other cases. But yeah, so it is tough as they get older, because obviously your friendships when you're, you know, 11, 12, 13 are a little more significant than when you're 5 or 6, 7 years old. So I think this may be one of the tougher moves because we have, a, you know, 13, 11 and a 9 year old. So they'll all definitely remember this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know I've got a couple things on tap, and I like these random shows. I kind of like to be surprised by whatever it is we're going to cover. And sure. Because, you know, this is kind of how we started these conversations out. I think we originally started these over a beer and just kind of kicking stuff back and forth and turned into kind of some interesting conversations. I think that's I kind of have the most fun with some of these random shows, maybe with the exception of some of the more cool, you know, interviews we've done. I think that the random shows are my most, you know, favorite because we get to just kick things around and you know, kind of explore different topics with no real expectation going in. So on that note, I thought we would start out kind of with what are you reading right now? You know, we've always, you know, been talking to all of our listeners about, you know, lifelong learning, and I have to, you know, that's something I definitely keep up with. I've always got multiple books I'm tearing through on a pretty regular basis. And currently I've got actually two I'm going through right now because of kind of the nature of those, which I can explain. But I'll let you start out first. What are you studying?
So obviously I would be remiss if I didn't mention my, you know, normal daily stuff that's kind of a recurring thing, 365 days. Well, I won't say 365 days. So, you know, I'm not as good as Jocko, so I'll say 360 days of the year, hopefully. You know, I read a little bit of Stoicism, typically the Daily Stoic, or, you know, a passage from one of the main Stoic philosophers like Marcus Aurelius or Seneca. But and then something called Strength for Service, which is a kind of a Bible reading a day with a little reflection from kind of like a perspective of service. So those are kind of my routine staples, I would say. So in terms of a rotational read, I've been interested in this one guy as he's been in the press more often. So I thought I would pick up his maybe his only book or his like most popular book. I know it's been made into like a Netflix movie, I believe, but it's called Hillbilly Elegy by a guy named J.D. Vance. And so he's an interesting dude. He was an enlisted Marine kind of at the beginning. Again, I got in like right at the beginning of the Iraq War. Did his 4 years and got out, you know, used his military benefits to go to Ohio State. And then he ended up going to Harvard Law School, which is a, kind of a big deal, and wrote this book. And now he's running for Senate in Ohio. So getting to have a little bit more higher profile, not only with the book, but running for Senate. But really, it's just a an interesting background of him. And it's all about, you know, kind of growing up in Appalachia, you know, like a guy from, you know, a challenged background. I think he was raised by his grandparents, you know, some, you know, broken relationships in his, you know, mother, father area, substance abuse, you know, poverty, fill in the blank. But it's kind of cool because it's a story about just his background of growing up in, you know, in that setting. And then to fast forward where he's at now, I think it breaks a lot of the narratives that you see on, you know, hey, if you're born into unfortunate circumstances, you know, you can't get out. And so, yeah, Hillbilly Elegy. So I've only gotten a little bit into it, so it's just kind of setting the background of a little bit what I talked about, you know, kind of coming from challenge beginnings, but knowing the end and where he's at now, you know, I'm excited to see all the challenges that he overcame to get to where he's at now. So yeah, Hillbilly Elegy. So
yeah, people are amazing. I love autobiographies, yeah, and you know, life stories like that. I love that. It's always amazing to see where people can come from, the things they can overcome, just the things, the randomness that the world brings to people that they either take opportunity with or that they falter with. I just think that's amazing. And so that sounds pretty interesting. I may have to pick that one up.
Yeah.
What else? You got anything else you're reading?
I'm still working on it's a little thick, and I think I mentioned it before, but it's a book called Fooled by Randomness. And the guy's kind of turned into almost a modern philosopher because he's also I like people with interesting backgrounds, right? That that I feel like I can, you know, glean something from. But it's the guy's last name is Taleb. It's like Nassim Nicholas Taleb, T-A-L-E-B. And so he was a like a Wall Street, you know, hedge fund kind of guy, but he had like a hard math science background. And kind of the subtitle is The Hidden Role of Chance in Life and in the Markets. And so the title gives a lot away, but he's basically saying in a lot of jobs, especially, you know, high profile jobs like the stock market, he almost makes it seem like 50-50. You can almost attribute as much to some luck as you can, you know, skill and proficiency by people, especially in areas where there's a lot of guesstimation going on. Right.
Right.
And so, yeah. And he does some interesting profiles of like kind of a tale of two cities, if you will, like a, you know, somebody who, you know, is very, outwardly successful and, but also like a big spender, and it's all about, you know, keeping up with, you know, the visuals or the optics of what they're doing. And then you have the person that's, you know, arguably more proficient, but, you know, they're less, I guess, apt to toot their own horn and be outwardly successful and maybe be a little more introverted. And so it's really cool. I mean, the guy, like I said, has turned into a bit of a modern philosopher on, and he's written like two or three books. He's kind of the one who modernized the whole Black Swan event terminology.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I heard this guy somewhere. Yeah.
So this one, I think maybe is his very, very first one, because I started from the beginning. But the Black Swan, I can't remember what that book, you know, is actually called. It may be the Black Swan, but I think that's the one that got, you know, more successful quicker. But I wanted to start from the beginning. So that one, I'm taking a ton of notes, and, you know, I feel like we're going to do a full podcast on just one of his books at some point. But that's the other one I'm kind of slowly working my way through it. But that's kind of the, you know, I typically have like a happier, easier reading, like the Hillbilly Elegy is almost like a, you know, just a story. I don't know if it's an autobiography necessarily, but it's, you know, kind of like a tale of, you know, an Appalachian family. And then, you know, The Fool by Randomness is a little meatier, thicker subject matter.
Yeah. Some books you just can't read straight through. I know that some of the things I've read in recent past and one I'm working on right now, you just have to take in chunks and sometimes digest them for a few days. And I find that I read heavier things in the morning and then lighter things in the evening towards, you know, bedtime. So I've usually got at least two books that I'm reading. So I guess on my list, I'll back up 1 week because I typically read a book about once a week. The most recent that I finished was called Traumatic Brain Injury, Clinical Approach to Diagnosis and Treatment. Now, this was written by Mark Gordon, Dr. Mark Gordon. And if you recall, I know we talked about him, I think, at some point in a previous episode. Mark Gordon was on the Joe Rogan show several times. And this is a doctor that has been studied. He's an endocrinologist. I guess he was a family practice doctor originally, and over the last 20 years, he became an endocrinologist, a specialist in hormone management. And he started working with people that had traumatic brain injuries. And he has written a fascinating book on all the work and research he's compiled on the relationship between traumatic brain injury and hormone disruption. And what's interesting about this is, and so he actually works with soldiers a lot. And so he got really tight with the special forces community. And he found that, you know, some of these guys are coming back and they've been exposed to like flashbang grenades and, artillery and heavy gunfire. And what we're learning now, and Dr. Gordon is very articulate and an incredible teacher, he is starting to show how these blasts, although externally you see no signs of injury, internally we're seeing disruptions in the pituitary gland, which is one of the master hormones in the body, master organs in the body that create hormones. And so we're seeing these guys come back with things that we're calling PTSD, we're calling depression, we're trying to blame on their war service or their exposures, but turns out they have dramatic hormone issues. And you fix those hormones and you adjust those, and lo and behold, their symptoms go away without medications, without antidepressants and all these kind of things. And he's been on the Joe Rogan show. If you've never heard him speak, he's really, you know, he's really entertaining to listen to. But I've actually read his whole book. I started using some of his protocols, and I've started working with my own patients that have had possible traumatic brain injuries, and using his, you know, his techniques. And I'm kind of in the middle of kind of going through with some training, some, you know, online, you know, postgraduate kind of training with Dr. Gordon in his program, because it's just so fascinating to me. And there's, and you don't have to be a soldier. I mean, how many people do you know that have had, you know, head injuries or, you know, got knocked out when they were a kid? And I've come across people like that. I had a guy recently that, you know, had severe depression. He's been in and out of jail and things like that. And I asked him one simple question: if you have any, had any bad head injuries in the past? Well, there was that one time when I was 8 and I got a guy hit me with his car on my bicycle and my head went off his bumper, knocked him out for a day. Okay, yeah. And then, you know, these kind of people, you end up scanning them and you find whole parts of their brain don't work. And they have, low testosterone and abnormal progesterone levels and abnormal growth hormone levels. And guess what? All of that can be replaced. So this has been a really powerful one for me, the Traumatic Brain Injury, Clinical Approach and Diagnosis by Dr. Mark Gordon. Don't try to go get it because it's limited edition, and I probably paid like $300 for that book. But it's like a gold mine. I keep going back to it over and over. It's chock full of research and stuff that just backs up everything you say. And I mean, it's in the weeds, detailed. It's really interesting.
Well, you know, what's so vitally important about, you know, folks like him and research like that is they not only uncover, you know, amazing things like that, but also it puts different perspective on run of the mill things, especially in the military, like training. Because right. I know a few times in training, just like you know, throwing a grenade or shooting a 50 caliber machine gun, like after you're done, you're like, man, that was you know, you get rattled a little bit, especially yeah. if you're hanging on too tight a little bit, or if you're like too close to, you know, where the concussion is coming out. And so I think over time they realize, like, hey, you know, we need to keep track of, you know, how many times they're shooting anti-tank weapons and throwing grenades and shooting 50 caliber, you know, weapons, because if they're doing it this much in training and then they go do it for real for 6 months off and on, you know, every other day, I mean, that, you know, it's almost like football players, you know, with the CTE research and a lot of that, realize, hey, we you know, it's one thing to have training camp and, you know, have some hitting and make sure you're conditioned enough to deal with it. But to, you know, hit during the week and then have a game, which is like a, you know, a car accident every Sunday on top of it, it's just not productive. You know, I mean, there has to be a basis, you know, almost like, you know, in martial arts and the Marine Corps and in martial arts in general, there's something called body hardening where, you know, I mean, you want to condition your nerves and your muscles to, like, hey, and we did drills like, you know, spinning back and forth and just hitting each other's forearms against another person's forearms, you know? And so you kind of, right. you know, get the nerves conditioned to, you know, absorb a blow so you can block kicks and hard punches. And so some of that can be good, right? You're protecting your body by conditioning it to do something, but there's kind of like a diminishing return when you know, whether it's full contact all week in football, full contact, you know, in a 6 week training camp leading up to a UFC fight, you know, sparring hard, we're right. punching people in the head with no headgear, and so I think that it's crazy that research that. That has taken that long, you know, when we've had the technology and the ability to do it, like, it takes a couple smart people to be like, hey, you know, what other kind of effects this have? And you know, bringing out, like you said, like hormones, you know, it's one thing to just talk about the physical trauma of your brain, you know, affecting different things, but hormone production, you know, which arguably is, you know, one of the most important things that happens inside of our body. I mean, to reveal that is huge. So that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. So the thicker book that I'm reading that is going to take me a little bit longer, and I have mentioned this in previous episodes, is The Full Catastrophic Living, Using the Wisdom of Your Mind, Your Body, Mind to Face Stress, Pain, and Illness. This was the Jon Kabat-Zinn book that I have been studying, and it is based on the idea of mindfulness-based stress reduction. This is a program that's been in medical centers throughout the world, and it essentially uses, if I had to give you a summary, it's all the science that underlies the truth behind the value of meditation, mindfulness, and yoga. And this book gives all the background, both scientifically and all the techniques that are used to do that. And it's really, really fascinating. It's so dense, though, I feel like I read a chapter and I've got to sit and ponder it for a while, you know, and it's not a book that you read straight through. And I'm trying to do the 6 week program that goes along with it, which is basically a meditative process. I meditate anyway, but I'm doing it according to their program and just seeing kind of what, you know, what I get out of that.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I really enjoy, a process or a practice where there's some deep science to it, but there's also a simplicity to it, right? You know, because I feel like I have to, it's like, okay, I can read research and absorb it and take it small bites, but then also I want to logically be able to make the connections. Like, for, you know, mindfulness and the practice of that and meditation is perfect for that, because, like, hey, there's all these studies that are coming out now and more studies being conducted that say, you know, if you do this, It helps with your concentration, helps with stress reduction, all these positive benefits. But also, just from almost a layman's perspective, you're like, oh, if I practice being calm and quiet in my mind when I have to do it, just like anything else, I practice it so I can quiet my mind. You know, I can get
Right.
back to like a centered place. And so I really like the whole concept. And we've talked about before, mindfulness is like, you know, you read the data and it's, you know, compelling, and you know, believe the science, and you're like, oh, and also how practical is that? That hey, if something crazy happens, I can go back to that place that I've been practicing. So, you know, that's awesome that you're going through that process.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, a lot of times science doesn't explain everything. It just doesn't. I mean, I've seen that over and over in my career with just you, things are just unexplained. And you know, whether it's a spiritual realm, whether it's, you know, a mind-body thing that we can't fully elucidate the exact reason it's happening, sometimes just quieting the mind and letting the body speak to you is beneficial. And I can tell you, I've meditated enough, your body does speak to you. And it'll typically tell you what's wrong. So take that for what it is. If you haven't meditated, try it. The last thing I'm reading, it's a little bit lighter. And I picked this book up because, you know, we had been working with the Corpus Christi Football Club, the Corpus Christi Sharks, which is a USL2 soccer team. I have been an assistant coach the last couple of years. And then this year, I've been their team physician. And I know you and I had been working on a sort of professional player development, you know, program for these guys. And so I was just trying to beef up some of the areas of that program. One of the things I came across was a book called The Champion's Mind, and it's how great athletes think, train, and thrive. This is by a PhD, Dr. Jim Aframo. And, you know, basically it's just a book of, you know, where he's put together research on, you know, kind of the game within the game. You know, how do we get the most mentally prepared for sport competition? And I think that's, you know, it's pretty easy read, and it's kind of broken down in a way that just gives you some bite-sized things that you could teach or pass along, either if you're an athlete or if you're, you know, coaching athletes. So that's the last of the things I'm reading right now. I've got a whole pipeline, but it would take another half hour to go through all the pipeline I've got. I usually have about 10 in a row,
That's
and
awesome.
I've got about five or six still in the box over there that I just kind of reach down and see what's next. I love that, you know, just the surprise of it.
Yeah, I was gonna say the funny thing about you mentioned that author, and I know he wrote a book. I think it was called like The Athlete's Gene or something like that. I think
Yes,
he's the same.
yes.
Yeah, so it's funny how whether it comes to books or podcasts especially, yeah, there's like a small degree of separation where like if you like or read one person's things, like you'll like other things they wrote.
Right.
Or, you know, Amazon and different podcast apps are really good about like, oh, if you listen to this, then here's three others. And then you come to find out the people you listen to or the authors you like are on the same types of podcasts. And so it's like the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of thing, right? You know, there's always like a connection when you get onto a good you know, line of thinking. So he's definitely one of those, like him and Malcolm Gladwell and others, where everything they come out with is cool. And they have a bunch of connections to some other good literature. So I'm glad you mentioned that one.
I think that when you read, you start to string ideas in different books string together sometimes. I find myself reading down a thread for quite a while, and then sometimes a book will sort of cross over and it will give me an idea somewhere else. And a lot of these books too will mention things that were, I guess, their muse, if you will. And it's interesting how, you know, you can just sort of kind of, it's kind of like just, I don't know, rafting down a river or something. When I read, I find other things as I go along. What's around the next bend? You know, well, this book will lead me there, you know, that kind of thing. So,
For
well,
sure.
we've been going at it for pretty good a while just on the randomness of our reading history here. You said you had something on maybe on leadership you've been kicking around. What's been going on there?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned some of the work we were doing with the Corpus Christi Sharks, and you know, one of the things that we started to put together is just through our own experiences in medicine and leadership and other things, was just a little bit of program for them. And obviously, you know, me with the leadership side on the military front, I just wanted to cover a few things I was thinking about, and sometimes it becomes more topical when current events happen, or in my case, where I'm coming to the end of one military tour and starting another one. So I just thought I would hit like a few bullets of kind of the basis of what we're trying to cover with the athletes on leadership. So
Yeah, right on.
yeah, so and really it's you'll hear some key themes when Dr. Curtis and I talk, and some of it, like you said earlier, just came out of random conversations over a beer. But I think if both of us could tie a thread to our success, there's a lot of consistency there to certain themes, whether it's the background of our podcast or leadership. So in this case, one of the key concepts is you can't expect to lead others if you can't lead yourself. And that ties to clearly our mission with the podcast to teach ourselves and others to master ourselves, master our craft, and be prepared for any mission. So I know that was an important foundation when we were creating something for the Sharks, is leading yourself. And sometimes that's the hardest, because we have bad habits, we have not the perfect background, we don't all have the same aptitude, and so the whole concept of leading yourselves if you want to expect to lead others, I think, is an important thing to remember.
Now, the hardest part about leading self is the idea that you have to really reflect and be introspective. You
Yeah, it can
almost
be
have to look at
painful.
yourself externally and say,
Yeah.
how does my behavior and action, how does that reflect on my values or that type of thing? And so you really have to, I guess the term is witness yourself. That's a term that gets used in meditative and mindfulness-based practices, is you have to quiet your monkey mind long enough to be able to look and say, what the hell am I doing here? What does my behavior look like externally if I were looking at myself?
Yeah, I mean, and that ties to an uncomfortable part for reasoning humans, which is being humble, right? Be having the humility to say, damn, I fell short in that area, or I always fall short in this area. I just got to find a way to mitigate it, So I think that the leading yourself, or mastering yourself, however you want to say it, part of it is ties to humility, which I think is an often skipped over part of leadership, that you have to admit when you're wrong, you have to admit when you don't know something, because you'll get into an emperor has no clothes situation, where just because you're in charge, doesn't mean that there's going to be a perfect outcome and people won't see through it, So I guess the next piece of it is, and this sh I know was this was empowering for me to realize, is that leadership is an acquired skill. No one is a born leader. We all have unique traits and skills that we use to be a leader, but no one is a born leader. And I think that whether, I don't know if it's movies or books, or if you have an opinion on it, but I know that there's like this overarching concept where, oh, so and so, you hear it, so he's a born leader, and it happens in sports, or maybe in politics. Somebody speaks well, or is a big person, or has a deep voice. But I don't know. What do you think about that whole idea of like the concept of born leader?
I think what we sort of identify as born leadership is probably a strong self-confidence that either
That makes sense.
came originally from maybe physical prowess, like,
Sure.
or maybe intellectual prowess, or just a sort of a developed skill in an area, where somebody got really, the 10,000 reps in whatever area. And so they ended up sort of very, very confident in that arena. Now, some people are very confident in a lot of arenas, and that comes across as a general confidence. But generally, people who are competent in whatever they're trying to do, or physically stronger, mentally, more robust than others, then they're confident in what they do. And when someone's
Sure.
confident, all animals, we are animals, but all animals see confidence in other animals. And that's, the whole, sort of hierarchy, if you will, alpha leader type kind of
Sure.
stuff that you could study. But I
Yeah.
think that's part of where that comes from, probably at a base, is just some type of mental intellectual or physical, you know, confidence.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And I know for me, you know, empirical evidence is king. You know, observing like I have, you know, some of the best leaders, I think has really taught me this concept, because I've seen people, you know, I'm so fortunate to be part of an organization where, you know, some of my friends are, you know, Joint Strike Fighter test pilots. And, you know, we had, you know, Marine Special Operations warriors that, you know, went to the Naval Academy, you know, all these people that exhibit all these, you know, extreme accolades. And the key theme that I've seen is there's no cookie cutter, right? And so I think that, right, you know, by observation, I learned that, you know, hey, some of us are really good at some things. And right, I think the challenge is to really, and it goes back to that self-examination, like knowing what you're good at, knowing what you struggle with, and try to put yourself in positions where you can succeed, you know? And right, I think that most of us would be surprised at how many things we can succeed in if we just admit, like, hey, you know, here's what I can do. I'm really good at these things. And you admit quickly without trying to cover it up, like, hey, you know, I'm not good at this. I'm gonna need some help in these areas, but these are right, the things that I can do. And that's like the common thing I've seen with people that are the best of the best. You know, they're really good at a few things, but they're also very honest with themselves. They're ruthlessly self-reflective on their shortfalls. And so I thought that was the key concept across, you know, so.
Yeah. Hey, I want to back up to the humility point you mentioned. Under humility, that's actually, if you think about it, that's an alpha trait. Humility, in a sense, is the social comfort with not caring what other people think enough to just simply not have to explain yourself. Yeah. And just live with how things are, you know.
For sure.
You're humble. Hey, this is the way this happened. I'll live with it, and I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to blame other people. I'm just simply going to understand that this is the way it is, and I'm going to understand that's either, you know, it is what it is. It's self-evident. It would not be an alpha behavior to brag about something.
Yeah.
You know, if you brag about it, then you're having to display how powerful you are, right? How look at me, look how good I am. I'm bragging about this, I'm bragging about that. That's why people don't respect braggarts or people like that, and they respect the humble leader. The humble leader is a confident leader, and humbleness is an alpha behavior. Because, you know, you don't need to go brag about what you do, how you do it, or, you know, your competence. It just is. It's self-evident.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a really smart way to think about it, because it's almost like a stealth alpha,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But it's that really the true alpha, because if you're strong enough to admit your weakness, and this has come out a lot in PTSD research, that you have to, you know, take away the stigma that, you know, you're not tough if you try to ask for help.
Right.
When exactly what you're saying is what the research shows, that the people that are really the strongest admit that they need help. Yeah. And then
right,
that goes for, you know, addictions of different kinds, PTSD, you know, we're using it to frame leadership, but you're exactly right. And, you know, I've seen it time and time again. And I think the last piece that I've really learned a lot through the volunteer work I've done, you know, with the Travis Manion Foundation, is the foundation to all leadership is having good character, right? Because,
yeah,
if you are honest, if you are doing the right things to the best of your ability, if you're not cheating, if you're not hiding, if you're not, you know, stealing, you know, whatever you want to fill in the blank with, if you have good character, if you're truly working hard, using your time and talents, you know, in all endeavors to do the best you can, you know, you will, you know, I would say 95% of the time succeed in anything you do, right? Because you're not going to give up. You're going to admit when you're wrong, and you're not going to lie about it when you make a mistake, you know, and you see it time and time again, whether it's politics or high level sports or, you know, medicine. If somebody makes a mistake and admits it, it's one thing. It kind of becomes, you know, not a story. But if you make a mistake and you cover it up and you lie about it and you try to, you know, next thing you know, you're before a grand jury and you're doing time for, you know, all the unethical stuff you did to cover up the one, you know, thing that you did wrong that you could have admitted and everybody probably would have forgiven you.
When you think about like character, I think about values, morals, but also I think a lot about purpose being authentic. And so, you know, if you just took those terms and say, yes, that is related to quality character, well, that's a human that's more effective in anything they do. They're going to be more consistent. They're going to be more reliable. They're just going to be more targeted, more focused, and more able to execute in any given environment if they have some type of stable character. Some type of firm character that allows them a basis to work from and make decisions from. If you don't have good character because you haven't thought or developed your own values, if you don't have a purpose, if you don't have any kind of morality, well, it's difficult, man. You're like making decisions and living your life on a trampoline. You know, you're all over the place. There's no firm bedrock to make decisions from that's going to have any consistency in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've fortunate or unfortunately, I've seen some extremes of the human condition. And I'll tell you that there's nothing like the confidence of knowing that you have good character behind you when things are not going well. And that's the other piece of this. Like everybody can have good character and make good, easy decisions when things are cool. But when things go wrong or people get hurt or, you know, there's legalities involved, you know, that's where you see people's true colors. And if you have nothing to hide, if you've been on the up and up, you know, regardless of the circumstances, you know, it's just like somebody accusing you of a terrible crime. Right. And if you maybe didn't do that crime, but you have some skeletons in your closet, you're going to be like, oh, well, I didn't do that. But I wonder if they're just, you know, saying that because they want to get to this other thing. So, I mean, you can get in this whole like paranoia killer loop, but if you truly are a person of character in all that you do, I mean, you'll sleep well at night. You won't second guess decisions. If somebody accuses you of something, falsely accuses you of something, you're just gonna be like, you know, and I think we've all seen it, you know, in business, in life, in, you know, media, in politics. I mean, you can usually tell when people are not guilty of stuff because you're just like, hey, give me, that's a lie. Give me a polygraph, you know, here's my alibi. I'm not that kind of person. I would never do anything like that. Whereas when you hear like, talk to my lawyer, no comment, you know, you make counter accusations, you know, all these things that happen. But if you're solid in your character, you're going to avoid so many things. And like I said, I think that's the bedrock of being, you know, a strong leader. And I think that's the last point that I had on that topic. So.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I guess we can wrap. I mean, this is random show number 98. We're coming up on our century mark there of episodes. I know we've been tentatively trying to square away some good interviews in the coming weeks, and I know I've got a big pile of, you know, full-on topics. So I guess let's, you know, just re-invite everyone to the Future Focus Health Network. That's where we have the WFO Life podcast tribe. And that's a place where it's kind of our social hub where sometimes we put exclusive content. Sometimes we interact. You know, you can ask questions or join a conversation on various topics. So if you're not into that, at least join the email list by going to WFOLifePodcast.com. And what happens there is you're able to get all our latest episodes as soon as they come out, and of course brought to you with all the show notes and all the things we talked about in the episode. So I appreciate all of those of you listening. And Chris, once again, it's been a great conversation, and look forward to chatting with you next week.
Sounds great.